rather.
And I'd like to thank everyone who's been involved in all the hours in that it's taken to get everyone here and to organise everything. Ongoing research project at the Centre for Alternative Technology. How many people have heard of CAT? Yeah! Cool. CAT is a grassroots organisation, but in 1977 it released its first and only, up till now, alternative energy strategy for the UK. It produced it and it sent it to government. It pointed out really a lot of the things that are troubling us now. It predicted a lot of the things that are happening. It said that we should be using more renewable energy and that energy and the economy couldn't grow exponentially. The Zero Carbon Britain project is really just a 30-year update of that report. And it's a report for policymakers, it's a report to central government. It can be read by everyone, but we're trying to infiltrate government and get them to understand the issues. And there's two major reasons why we've decided that needs to complement CAT's grassroots usual organisation. One reason is because currently government policy is part of the problem and not part of the solution in all different areas of our lives. And until government really starts to engage with the issue and understand it, it will continue to be part of the problem. It will continue to expand roads, it will continue to build more runways and to make it harder for us to live in the communities that we want to live in and to live the low energy lifestyles. And the second reason is because there's a certain part of the population that we believe are just unengageable, that they will not engage with these issues and they do not really care about it. And government has the power to force those people to engage. I don't know how many of you saw the Mayor Hillman workshop earlier, but he was making the point that this can't just be a voluntary thing, unfortunately. We have to use government's power to be able to engage everyone. I know. Well,
what are they, Sam?
When we started the project, we wanted to decide and to try and show that how much Britain could contribute to a global solution to climate change with the added constraints that we're currently facing of peak oil and global equity. We had to show how much we could power down our current energy waste and how much we could power up the renewable supply. And we were asking the question, could those two meet? So could we power Britain 100% renewably? And the answer is yes, we can. We can. So we started the report by looking at what the issues were, and having crunched the numbers and done the research, we realised that climate change was really the one that's going to bite more than the others and would make work on global equity in the long term really become meaningless if we didn't address it. Global inequity would be a better one. Yes. The first point to make on the climate change front is that 2 degrees is not safe. 2 degrees is a magnitude of warming that human civilization has never experienced. 2 degrees is a compromise in itself, and we're already, with that target, negotiating away thousands of species and probably millions of lives. But having said that, it is a tipping point, and it does lead to unthinkable consequences, which, if any of you haven't read Mark Clancy's book, 6 Degrees, I'd recommend. You hear a lot of numbers bandied around in the climate change world, of stabilisations of atmospheric concentrations, 450, 500, 550, CO2 or CO2 equivalent. Make sure it's CO2 equivalent when you're talking about it, because that's important. 450 seems to be this kind of figure at the moment that seems safe, but unfortunately that only gives us a 20% chance of avoiding the 2 degrees tipping point. 20-30% chance. That's not really good enough. We need to be stabilising those rates at 400 or less. Currently we're at between 430 and 459, so we need to be less than the current stabilising, we need to be less than the atmospheric concentrations that we're at now. We need to reduce the ones that we're at. And if you look at how much carbon we're polluting and chucking into the atmosphere every year, at the moment about half of that is sunk by the Earth system, by the Earth's carbon sinks. So it seemed that maybe if half of that is taken up, we could just reduce our emissions by 50% to stabilise, we could reduce our emissions by 60% if we wanted to reduce the level. but it's not quite that simple, unfortunately. The Earth's carbon sinks are degrading, and they're degrading quite rapidly, and that's because of temperature-driven feedbacks. So whatever we do with the concentrations in the atmosphere, those sinks will continue to degrade. When you also factor in the fact that our population is going to grow significantly, you get some really harrowing numbers. You get to the point where, by 2030, the natural carbon sink for each of us, for each person globally, will be no more, absolutely no more than 1.5 tonnes of CO2 equivalent. And given that we know we're already too high and our atmospheric concentration too high, our emissions are all going to have to be way lower than that, way lower than 1.5 tonnes. And by 2050, the carbon sink will be even less. And that's why we called our project Zero Carbon Britain, because we really just have to move beyond fossil fuels. Fossil fuels don't just heat our homes and power our cars. They fuel instability, from the oil drenched Middle East to the smoke-choked cities of the developing world. What we have is an emergency unfolding in slow motion. Given that it's an emergency, we decided at the Centre for Alternative Technology, what is a conceivable time frame that we could move to zero emissions? And we decided that that would be 20 years. Like I said before, if Britain's going to act, it has to be in a global context to have any credibility, because this is a global problem. So we had to search for an international framework, an international solution to climate change. And so we picked contraction and convergence, which many of you may have seen the workshop earlier. How many of you have heard of contraction and convergence? That's a pretty good, great. From the contraction convergence model, we could then devise a 20-year budget for Britain, and we could plot an energy descent. We then had to decide, how best do you manage that energy descent? How do you allocate it most efficiently? How do you make sure that we don't have civil unrest on a grand scale? For that, we chose tradable energy quotas, some work by David Fleming. How many people have heard of TECs, PQs? A lot less. It's very similar to what Mayor Hillman was talking about earlier in his workshop, with just one slight difference. It's an electronic carbon allowance system that incorporates business as well. So you split the current usage in Britain of fossil fuels, and you say that you give 40% free to individuals, and you auction the 60% to business. So as an individual, you only ever use your tax, your allocation, on fuel. So you'll use it on gas, on electricity, on coal, if you even something like that. So you're giving up tax when you purchase fuel. So if you go to a supermarket, the only place you would use your tax would be at the forecourt in the garage at the front. Once you got in the store, the emissions are represented in the price of the goods. So business has to buy its tax, it has to purchase them on an auction. So the cost of those emissions are incorporated in the price of the product that you buy. So things from far away, kiwi fruit from New Zealand, become very, very expensive. Whereas local, organic food becomes much cheaper. The other thing that does is it drives a huge innovation towards renewable energy, because you don't have to use your tax for renewable energy and low carbon technologies. The tax is also tradable. So it means a vast majority of the population, a majority of them, and a vast majority of the people here would receive a windfall, because if you're here, you should be less than average. And if you're less than average, you can sell your tradable energy quotas, your tech, an electronic system through your bank account, and you can sell them for money. The people who emit more than average, the people who are flying away on their holidays to Tuscany all the time, they're going to have to buy lots and lots of tech. So what you have is a redistribution of wealth. It's a very progressive system. It also provides a common purpose for all of the population, because it engages everyone in the system. To keep the cost of tax down, we have to manage our use of fossil fuels efficiently. We have to keep demand down. So the rich person going off and flying lots is causing the price of tax to go up for everyone. And that gives an incentive for all of us, individually, to find ways to cajole them and to engage with them to reduce their emissions. So it has a very, very powerful social side. Having taken those two policies, an international framework and a national framework, we then ran an energy model, just a scenario. 20 years, what could Britain do with the current technologies or emerging technologies based on proven engineering? And we took a worst case scenario. We called the model Island Britain. We assumed that Ireland, that Britain would have to provide all its own energy and food from within its borders and coastal waters. So it has to be self-sufficient. No energy imports, no food imports. So could Britain do that in 20 years? Wean itself off fossil fuels, power and feed itself. In the power down section, we looked sector by sector at the implication of techs. So we looked at transport, and we saw that most likely there would be a massive switch to electric vehicles, electric light goods vehicles, a switch to cycling, obviously, and walking, and a switch back to the rail network for freight. And we realised that we could power down our overall energy demand by 50%. Buildings, there would be a massive programme by the government to insulate buildings and provide solar hot water, PV arrays. In agriculture, we'd be mainly switching over to organic, almost entirely organic. It wouldn't be Soil Association standard organic, but it would be without the use of fertilisers, and it would be pretty close. We'd also have a lot of short rotation copsing, growth of miscanthus, biofuels, and we'd have a two-thirds reduction in meat as well. Within our scenario, there's a choice between meat or food, almost. So much land is taken up and so much energy is taken to produce meat that under our limited constraints it just had to be reduced to be able to feed the population.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're going to try and keep this
In the power-up section, we realised that with a diverse mix of renewables, we can power the whole of Britain. We're moving much more to an electrical Britain. We have to answer two questions, which is how much energy can renewables provide, and can they deal with the variable demand and variable supply? Those questions that renewables pose to us. And with a distributed location and a distributed mix, we've realised that we can. It would be very expensive within the scenario, and it would be very, very difficult because we can't import any energy. Integration with Europe would be much, much easier, and I think that's something George wants to talk about later, and it would obviously make it much cheaper. So there is optimism, because we can do it under that scenario, even within the most constrained limits. So from our project at the moment, we're going to carry it on, we'll continue our research, and we'll publish a report next year and the year after if we have to. And we've come to the conclusion that a zero carbon Britain is scientifically inescapable, economically unavoidable, but technically possible. And now we're all here to make sure that it's politically and socially thinkable. Thank you.
One thing to say before we hand over to George Monbiot, and that is that this debate is going to continue on in the London area after it finishes here. And I want you to keep your questions that you have for Richard in your head, because we're going to be opened up to questions later. Over to you, George.
Thank you very much. And it's just wonderful to be here. This is the best action since the 1990s, except it's even better because this time it's organised. I can scarcely express my admiration for the people who planned this, and indeed for all of you for coming here and making a stand. It's against our own immediate best interests, but it's in our long-term best interests, so thank you all. We should all thank ourselves for being here. But I'm going to start with some bad news, and the bad news is this, that 2 degrees is no longer the target. And the news is contained in a recent paper written by James Hansen of NASA in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. And what Hansen shows is that the profoundly pessimistic assumptions in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, Working Group 3, are insufficiently pessimistic. And the reason for this is as follows, that the IPCC assumes that the melting of the ice sheets at the poles will take place in a gradual and linear fashion. And Hansen's own work with the paleontological record shows that is an entirely implausible, to use his term, scenario. Last time we had 2 degrees of warming in the mid-Pliocene, 3.5 million years ago, the ice sheets at the poles did not melt as the IPCC proposes over the course of millennia, but within the course of one century. And they did not cause a maximum sea level rise within the course of one century, as predicted by the IPCC, of 59 centimetres, but of 25 metres. And Hansen proposes that through a series of factors, the collapse of the buttresses which prevent the ice sheets from sliding into the sea, the meltwater trickling down through crevasses and lubricating the base of the ice sheets, and meltwater on the surface of the ice sheets changing the albedo, making them darker and therefore absorbing more heat, will lead to the sudden and, certainly in geological terms, almost immediate collapse of both the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet within the course of a century at somewhat less than 2 degrees of warming. Not only does this lead to the immediate effect of the inundation of most of the habitable world, something like 60% of the world's people live within 50 kilometres of the coast, it also means that you get a severe and sudden albedo change, a global albedo change, as the white stuff at the poles gives way to dark stuff absorbing much more solar radiation. And he proposes that we can't go beyond 1.5 to 1.7 degrees of warming above 1990 levels. Combine this with what Richard was talking about and the stuff contained in the Working Group 3 document of the IPCC's fourth assessment report, which shows that in order to have a maximum cap of 2 degrees warming, we need an 85% global reduction, even before you take population growth into account. So when that's added to the fact that we're going to have something like a 50% increase in population, you can see that that pushes way over 90%. And even before you take the issue of global equity into account, which means that us in the rich nations must cut our emissions much further than anybody else, you realize that we are talking at a minimum of a 100% cut, and it looks like it might have to go to 110 or 115. You laugh, but actually, we're talking about sequestration here, and we're talking about such things, for example, as growing biofuel and burying it. Simply for, you know, growing as much biomass as we can and sticking it back in the ground, creating new coal measures, something, anything to stave off this catastrophe. So, We're not talking any more about measures which require a little bit of economic tweaking here and there, a little bit of political tweaking here and there. We are talking about measures which require global revolutionary change. And that is a much tougher message than any that I've put out before. And this is the first opportunity, really, I've had since that paper came out to express the fact that the what I thought were rather bold and rather revolutionary proposals in my book, Heat, don't go nearly far enough. Those proposals have been superseded. We need to start thinking on a different scale altogether. Now, what the people at the Centre for Alternative Technology have done is extremely bold, and it's exactly the sort of step which we need to be considering. Embedded in their report are quite a few fairly optimistic technological assumptions, like, for instance, electric propeller-powered planes, which don't exist and probably never will, but we can forgive you one or two of those. But there's also a profoundly pessimistic technological assumption, which is that we remain an island as far as energy supply is concerned. And of course, that's Kat's fully aware, and Richard is fully aware, that is a pessimistic assumption. It need not be like that. In fact, it cannot be like that. And I'm afraid the second uncomfortable message I have to put out to you tonight is that when it comes to dealing with a problem on this scale, small is no longer beautiful. We have to start thinking on the biggest possible terms. And there's been a great deal of wishful thinking as far as dealing with this problem is concerned, where people have latched onto the solutions they like the look of. And of course, we all like small scale solutions which we can control, which are within the human ambit, on a human scale. That's what we all want, that's what we all love. But unfortunately, that's not going to work. That doesn't answer the challenge that we're faced with. And if you look at for instance, micro wind generation or solar panels, rooftop solar PV in this country, it doesn't even touch the problem which we're trying to deal with. I mean, your 1.75 meter wind save 1,000 wind turbine will provide about 5% or so in most locations of your household electricity use, even after you've cut it back somewhere. Solar panels at this latitude provide no more than that, possibly in many circumstances less. And it's a very poor way to use money, which is going to be in scarce supply for spending on the solutions that we do need. We need, unfortunately, and much as I hate this scale of development, we need to be looking quite at the other end of the spectrum. And the only thing, I believe, which is going to start to answer this case at the European level is to start creating a European supergrid. And the purpose of this is to tie up our variable renewable power sources, such as wind, such as waves, such as tidal, with non-variable certain sources, such as, for instance, the hydroelectric schemes in Scandinavia, getting more ambitious now, massive desert solar in North Africa, and getting still more ambitious, the geothermal plants in Iceland. And it sounds crazy that you could have a grid which could tie all that together. But at the moment, our electricity is transmitted by means of alternating current, which is a very inefficient, a very clumsy, and a very expensive way of moving electricity over long distances. It has a huge land take. Those horrible pylons that we all know and hate, they are very big. Alternating current pylons are much, much bigger than the alternative, which I'll come on to. You lose a great deal of your electricity in transmission, so that beyond about 600 kilometres, it's simply not worth transporting it anymore. If we're going to start looking at solutions on the scale of a European supergrid, we're talking about 2,000-4,000 kilometres of transmission. And what answers that case is high voltage direct current. The theoretical limit for direct current lines is about 4,500 kilometres. Already there's a line in the Congo of something like 1,800 kilometres. It is feasible, it works today, it works already. It has a much smaller land take than alternating current, and it's much cheaper. You lose much less electricity in transmission. Now, I hate this sort of thing. I detest the creation of pylon lines. I detest the scale of the measures which we're going to be talking about. But it is that, or succumbing to planetary catastrophe. And I have to put my aesthetic feelings to one side in favour of my humane feelings towards dealing with a problem which will otherwise destroy the lives in a literal and physical sense of billions of people. So I would like to see very, very large scale wind farms way off the coast, 100 miles or so offshore, with every 100 kilometres offshore, wind speeds increased by 1 metre per second. You can also build on a very, very large scale out there. The only people whose aesthetic sensibilities are going to challenge will be trawler men. You can have 10 megawatt wind turbines on shallow seas on the continental shelf, way out of the range of objection for anybody who could possibly see them. You have very, very large solar thermal arrays in North Africa, making use of this extraordinary resource we have in the Sahara, where you've got very high solar radiation, very low cloud cover, and even better, it runs from east to west, which means that when the sun's going down at one end, it's rising at the other end, so that you can get something like 15 hours of continuous power from there. And potentially a very, very long undersea cable running all the way from Iceland into Scotland, and then tapping into the grid that way. This is a scale on which we need to think. And a project on that scale cannot possibly happen without transformative politics of the kind that we all subscribe to, but that we need somehow to turn into practical action. Transformative politics which require that climate change becomes the overwhelming political consideration, which require that governments see that nothing can happen without their involvement. And to the anarchists in the audience, I apologise. I wish it were otherwise. There's a small bit of anarchism in my heart too, but we have to have massive scale government investment. And that means that what we're seeing here, wonderful as it is, has to be only the beginning. We have very, very little time in which to act. We have very, very little time in which to bring about the biggest economic and political transformation the world has ever seen. But we have even less time not to bring it about. We have even less time to wait for the alternative, which is infinitely more hideous even than the proposal that I'm suggesting. So I'm sorry that I don't have much cheering news to bring you. But the one thing I would say is this, that faced with this extraordinary, horrendous, depressing situation, we're also faced with the realization that we are now the most powerful people who will ever again live on Earth, because it is only us who can turn this situation around. There's no one else to wait for who will do it in our stead. And unless we use this extraordinary empowerment, well, obviously, we will be reneging on the greatest responsibility which has ever been placed on people's shoulders. But I urge you to see that power as a source of hope, because it rests with people who are waking up to what needs to be done. I'm sorry it's such a short talk, because there's so much we need to talk about, but please, if you can, come to the London tent with us afterwards. These are the absolutely critical issues. They determine where we take it beyond this climate camp, where we take it beyond our everyday lives, where we take it beyond our home lives, where we take it beyond our working lives. It determines the kind of people that you and I are going to be over the next few years. And we have to work it out right now and start acting on it. Thank you very much.
My politics and my ideas have been very much informed by the amazing and intelligent people that I've been lucky enough to work with. So that's my sort of position here on the panel. And first of all, I'd just like to make a comment on the progress the sort of discourse around climate change has really made. And I mean, even just a year ago, when everyone talked about climate change, we were talking about the science and about how frightening it was, and that alone. And it's fantastic that these guys here have been part of the people who have been really engaging themselves and thinking, okay, let's take a breath, let's think about what we have to do and when and how we're going to get there, and coming out with this answer that yes, we could make this change. The solutions are possible, and that's a fantastic step forward for the discourse, and I'd like to thank them for that. But my question is slightly different, because I think there's a huge question that's left unanswered. And that's, why are we not making the changes? We have these facts laid out so clearly in front of us, but the changes aren't being made. We have to ask ourselves, what is it about the nature of the society that we live in that means we can have these facts laid out and we can still have crazy decisions like third runways being built at international airports in this country? That is madness. We have to name that madness, we have to understand that madness, we have to find the brakes, and we have to pull them. Woo! Okay, so I'm going to talk about politics, so please bear with me and try not to get too bored. So I've broken it down, so I want to deal with this in kind of three sections. First of all, I'm going to look at the economic system as an obstacle. Secondly, I'm going to look at fossil fuels and global power as an obstacle. And thirdly, I'm going to look at consumer patterns. Now, of course, all these are interconnected. And it's quite difficult, actually, to pull them apart, but I think for the sake of sort of explanation, it's useful. And I think it's interesting to note that I found it very difficult to pull a section that would be called political will, although I know that that's a term that's used in the booklet when they describe this actual gathering here today. So I think we have to bear in mind that political will is in fact intrinsically connected to all three of those factors. I'm going to try and explain that a little bit more as I go through. Now, so first of all, I'm going to deal with the economic system. Now, I think everyone here will be familiar with the phrase that we can't have perpetual economic growth on a finite planet. And we have to remember that this is not simply about private corporations, but economic growth and perpetual expansion is a mantra, and it's a beat that drives decisions both from governments and from corporations. So there's an example of these two political and economic factors being combined. Now, a classic example of this is the decision to build the third runway here. It's a mantra that you can't stop. We have to move forwards. We have to make profits. You have to keep expanding. There's no time to take a moment to make reasonable decisions because of the threat of international competition. But we have to be brave enough to break that rhythm. And in fact, that's a very big challenge in its own right. Okay, I'm going to move on to the second point, which was fossil fuels and global power structures. And again, we're not looking at corporate interests in isolation. And I hope, as I say, I'm going to explain why not as I go through the section. I think it's really important to remember that the planes going overhead that we hear when we're trying to get to sleep at night at the moment, the problem with them is the fossil fuels in their tanks. And we have to remember here that the enemy is fossil fuels. And I think it's interesting to remember that when we're talking about carbon rationing and the proposals that are put forward by both of my friends here today. Because I don't know a huge amount about the ins and outs of each of those options, but I know whichever version we went for, it would mean reductioning in fossil fuels. And it would mean that those reserves of fossil fuels as yet left untapped would have to remain underground. And I can't overemphasize that that would be a massive challenge, because the issue here is about power, and power of the fossil fuel industry in the world. Now, we all know that wars are being fought at this very moment over fossil fuels. And so it's very, very clear this is about both the fossil fuel industry and about governments. And we all know the economic prospects of countries and, in fact, whole continents rise and fall with fossil fuel discovery. Read my notes. So, of course, this is connected between, again, economics and politics. But now, I think it's the reason why I pulled this out as a separate issue, because I think there is a separation here to be made between the agenda of giant fossil fuel companies and the agenda of free market economists. I think there's something a little bit clear here, especially since the Stern report, which made clear that even some economists are realising that it's not economically viable not to tackle climate change at all. Not that I'm saying that the proposals put forward in the Stern report go far enough, but I think it's interesting to note that it's the global elite of the fossil fuel industry have vast, vast concentrations of power, and they will do everything they can to make sure all of that fossil fuel under the ground is burnt, and they are a major obstacle. And we need to take the power that's now in their hands back. And me the most complicated factor, consumer patterns, and here's the one I find most difficult. It's very, very complicated, and I obviously am not going to have time to go into this one in all its intricacies, but we've obviously got workshops throughout the camp where we can be possibly talking about this. Now, the first debate in this regard is whether we actually have an economy driven by consumers, and I would really contest that. I really think that we have high streets at the moment full of McDonald's and Costa Coffee, not because if you give people the money and the freedom, that's what everyone would choose. I think we have to be really clear that we're being fed an illusion that somehow consumer choice is driving this. And I think that's really important that we always remember the other two factors that I've talked about. It's also really important to remember other factors, cultural factors, massive advertising campaigns, media, effectively the manufacture of desires. And just to remember that ultimately that we reproduce our culture. From the moment that we're born, we live and we learn and we copy what's around us. And so what we're talking about is the reproduction of our culture and a change in that. And actually it's very difficult to step out of that culture, but we have to make sure that we are those who are driving this forward. But this factor, I think, of consumer patterns has been given disproportionate airtime. So I'm not going to go into it now. Everyone's talking about green products and consumer choice. And I know at least the media team has tried to take this opportunity to readdress the balance. We have to focus on economic and political factors, because as far as I can see, they are driving the problem. We cannot talk about lifestyle choice. We have to talk about our whole society with economics and politics together. So that was the three obstacles. And now I'm going to talk about moving forward. Now, I do have a concern that within the green movement at the moment, there's a tendency that some people are dealing with this issue of urgency in a problematic way. Of course, this is the sort of issue that can send you into a panic. I mean, this is really very frightening, and we absolutely need urgent action. So it's hardly surprising that this is happening. But I think that it's dangerous, because an argument seems to be made sometimes that in order to make these changes fast enough, we're going to have to leave the radical social change behind. Somehow people are saying that social change and action on climate change can somehow be separated and dealt with independently. But my argument is that this is simply not possible for the reasons that I've outlined before when I talked about the obstacles, and particularly economic and political obstacles. And secondly, and I think this is really important, because of the real risk of very dangerous political responses taking hold to climate change. Some of these responses could escalate to a humanitarian disaster in themselves rather than prevent one. Let me explain. Right now, corporations are trying to steal the climate change agenda. They're talking about techno fixes, perhaps, and greenwash. And if we don't take back the agenda, we're facing a frightening future. We have to remember that when the going gets tough, the global rich will do all they can to protect themselves, and hugely exacerbating existing divisions of wealth. You think immigrants and refugees have a hard time now? You think it's immoral to have bloody wars going on in the Middle East? You think a market-based rationing system allowing those in the rich West to buy themselves way out of the problem while allowing those in the poor global South to live without any form of infrastructure would be unfair? Well, that could be nothing in compared to what could happen next. The men at the top of government and business in the West might well, in the end, pull their finger out and make some form of changes, at least to protect themselves. But that future is frightening and must also be resisted. This is a time for being responsible. And it's only responsible to deal with climate change as part and parcel of the economic and political system that's driven us into this mess in the first place.
Thank you, Sophie. And Again, just a reminder to sort of like keep these questions in your heads about these issues to the end. I'm just going to hand over now to Ollie, our last speaker.
Hello. Well, I was talking to someone earlier about history. Welcome to history. This is what we're doing at the moment. We're making history. I want to just talk a little bit more about the camp, really, and the role that the camp's got, and I'm going to cross over a bit with some of the stuff that Sophie said. The first thing is, this camp is not the answer. I hope nobody thinks how much of a good time they're having at this camp is anything like anywhere near enough of an answer. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny step on the way to an answer. In fact, it's much more a fucking big question. I think there's four crucial things about the camp. We are, firstly, we're upfront about the necessity for a social movement. Secondly, we criticise and fight against the capitalist growth economy. Thirdly, we are recognising that corporations have stolen a lot of the agenda around climate chaos, that it's still their power in the media that's driving a lot of the discourse, and that we ordinary people need to take the discussion, the debate, and the answers and the solutions back. Lastly, that we're here and we're having a good time and we're featuring on the front pages because we've got the passion and the excitement that's going to make the difference in the long run. Yeah. I'm going to just go into a bit more detail on a couple of those. The first couple on social movements. It's, as Sophie said, it's brilliant that we're getting reports, that we're getting research now on how we can make the technical changes that are necessary and what steps are needed, but all those are just paper unless there is a social movement of people to animate them. Yeah. It's totally crucial. We have to leave fossil fuels in the ground, and because, as Sophie said, there's huge forces trying to pull them out of the ground, the only thing that's going to be strong enough to keep them in the ground is a social movement that's stronger than those forces. So, how do we make a social movement? Well, answers on a postcard. We get together, we educate ourselves, we talk, we party, and we take action. Fundamentally, we form common struggles and common experiences so that we are linked together by common ideas, by common work, by common feelings of solidarity. And in our case, I think what's more and more necessary is that we withdraw consent and our participation from the current economic system. And there's no single answers about how that's done. That's down to every single person to look at their role in the economic system and start saying, how the fuck do I get myself out of this? And fast. Just before this meeting, there was a discussion, the debates going on about what sort of action we're taking at the weekend, and some of the questions were around breaking the law. A part of extracting ourselves from the current economic system is probably going to mean that we're going to have to break the law a little bit. Okay, I probably need to carry on without all the breaks, otherwise we'll never get back to the really important discussion, which is what action we're going to take at the weekend. Almost all social progress has meant breaking laws, because laws are made by elites to establish, protect, and ensure the continuance of the status quo. Yeah. So it's not enough, but it's okay to break the law. And people, there was a lot of people here earlier who seemed concerned about that, and I just wanted to have this opportunity to say that that is going to be part of the thing that we have to do, which is look at the situation that we need and work out how to get there and not listen to those who are in power saying, well, you can't do this, that's not allowed. But we need to look at the problems that have been talked about earlier and say this is allowed because we're dealing with something much more serious than your position in the global elite. We're talking about the future of all life on Earth. Yeah. So maybe, you know, a bit further down the line, we can, when there's 20,000 people here, when there's 10 of these going on at the same time, when there's 40 of these going on around Europe, when there's 500 of these going on around the world, then we can say we're starting to create a social movement. And that's when we're all going to start getting really excited and probably even more exhausted. but we'll know things are changing. The second thing I wanted... the growth economy... again, it was mentioned earlier, you know, we're all brought up with the idea that progress means increasing material wealth, it means growth, it means economic growth. We can't live without increasing material prosperity. That's something we have to start changing. We have to start understanding that now, for a lot of us in the West, and obviously it applies to us in the West, not to everybody on the planet at the moment, that less is in fact more. That's okay, because the things that we all probably, hopefully, really get out of living, the things that we all need, are not very carbon intensive. You know, friendship, community, family, hanging out, eating healthy food, living in a safe world. None of these things need to ensure huge carbon emissions. You know, it's crazy that we've gone into this mess and we have to go back to first principles to look at what are the things that make living joyful and fulfilling. And now that we've got a lot of material progress, we don't need all this new extra stuff. And we have to start saying no to it and saying no to other people increasing the demands for it. Lots of work has been done about showing the links between... Or the lack of a link between increasing material wealth and happiness. And I'm not going to go into that now, but there's plenty of research out there from New Economics Foundation and various other people. And I think hopefully here we're getting a taste of that this week. That's what's successful and what's joyful is not about a commercial relationship. Why is the camp being successful? Capitalism wants to control us, it wants to profit from what we're doing, it wants to encourage greed and individualism, and this camp is about mutual aid and common aims and solidarity and creativity and about entering into non-commercial relationships with people, and that's what's satisfying, and that's the world that we have to be creating even as we're dealing with all these incredibly serious and important technological and physical economic changes that are necessary. And it's a huge, exciting challenge to work out how we can do that. It's not a challenge that we should feel gloomy about. It's much more exciting than anything else we're doing in our lives, I think. Okay. I'm just sort of cutting out. just to end. You know, every society, every culture does need a story, and we've been sold a story for quite a long time, you know, for the last 30, 40 years about growth and our relationship to the rest of the world and resource use and material living. I think what's going on here and why this is exciting is because there's a lot of people out there in the world now who realise that that story is ending. You know, we can look around the world and see that story about, which is basically based on exploitation, imperialism, and stealing other people's resources and all a sort of get rich quick attitude is ending, whether we like it or not. It's time to start making a new story. This is why there's so much interest in the camp this week, because lots and lots of people can see that. We're telling a new story that's not based on greenwash. It's not about changing your light bulb. It's about seeing much, much further than that. It's a story about how we're really going to get down to the nitty-gritty of making the changes. And as we change our talk, which is what hopefully we're doing here this week, we change our mindset, because we surround ourselves with ideas and cultures and stories of how other people are changing their mindset. As we change our mindset, our actions change. As our actions change, it changes our talk further. And we go round and round in a virtuous circle. And we've made the changes because we've gone round the circle so many times. thank you very much.
is going to work. He's a bit like Kilroy. So take a seat and look angry. We've all got issues. So what we'd like you to do is, like, we're going to basically take questions. I'm going to run around with a microphone. Jane's got the other one to address the panelists with. And if you could address your question to one person, we're going to then ask that person to answer it, but then open it up to another person on the panel. So instead of question time with the answer, everyone, we're just going to have two answers per question, if that's all right, because we haven't got much time. So, Jane, do you want to over to you and I'll go running around?
Okay, well, there was a lot of people with their hands up a moment ago, and now I can see two, and there was somebody waving over there, but maybe they were waving at their friend. So we've got to take 1, 2, 3. Oh my god, and there's loads at the back, so wait, if I haven't spotted you, there's 4 over there, and 5.
I'd like to ask this gentleman here, who did a talk on low impact living, how he sees George's chat about the super wind turbine and the European super grid. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'm quite happy to buy it.
Well, yeah. Well, there's no short answer to that. I mean, I don't know the detail of what that proposal would mean. I really would have to defer to looking at, you know, what the impacts would be. At the moment, my understanding is that we can live a perfectly decent life without needing that sort of engineering. And, you know, but it's based on a lot of ideas about what level of material prosperity, what level of electricity, what level of transport we're all going to need. And I don't have the answers to that. I think if we want and we spread the ideas of simple living, that can actually be joyful enough for everyone without that stuff.
Okay, so it's only fair that George has a reply.
Thanks so much. Of course, I'm a great advocate of simple living as well. And those of us who have already taken a step and seen what needs to be done, by all means, let us live simply. But unfortunately, we have a planetary emergency which requires an emergency response which involves everybody on Earth and involves them right now. And much as I would love to see this being done by means of the social and psychological transformation alone, that's not going to be fast enough. We need instantly to be able to produce sources of energy which allow people to live not in the way they're living today, but in a way which resembles to some extent the one they are accustomed to living in. Otherwise, it's just not going to be feasible within the necessary time frame. Now, I don't like that any more than Ollie likes that, any more than any of you like that. But I'm trying to be realistic about this problem, and I'm trying to be realistic about the solutions. Now, we need at the same time, simultaneously, to be working towards the destruction of the capitalist system, towards the destruction of the exploitative, resource-hungry system, towards the destruction of the energy-hungry system. But that energy descent has to start at the top from where we are, not start at the bottom. We need to find a way of working down by stages from where we are, but that has to begin by replacing the carbon-intensive energy sources we use today by non-carbon energy sources. Then we move towards reducing the energy sources altogether. But that carbon substitution has to be the immediate step we take. I was going to say the first step. First is too late. It has to start right away, and it has to be something which can, by its very nature, include everybody in this country, everybody in Europe, ultimately everybody on Earth.
Okay, I'm just saying, taking hands is going to be a slightly inexact science in a group this big, but bear in mind that we will all be moving, those of us who want, to the London neighbourhood, so people will hopefully get a chance to ask their questions. And we've got a 2 and a 3, and we've got a 4 over there, and a 5, and that's all I'm going to be able to remember for now, so we'll have to do hands again after that.
I would like to ask, is it Paul from Cat? Richard, you when you were talking about your report, like one thing you mentioned is that you see that there are certain groups in society which will not want to check. Now, I would like to hear from you, like, which groups you think they are, and then why you think they would want to change.
Well, we haven't done an extensive amount of social research into what those particular groups would be. I wouldn't like to stereotype and call the general public without thinking about individual. I mean, individuals. It's very difficult to talk and generalise in that way. I think we all know who some of those people are. I think we've all engaged with them previously or spoken to them or just aware of some of the people that are going to find it very difficult to engage with the issue because they have other priorities. I think the carbon allocation system is a way of enforcing that engagement with everyone and providing a common purpose for all the people to really understand what the issue is. And without wanting to use a buzzword, it kind of brings about a carbon consciousness of the general public that we're all in this together. Because a few of us can't just suddenly decide to change and leave everyone else staying the same. It has to be a global effort.
Hi, Ollie. Hello. This is Raga. Hi.
Calm down.
I remember you from years back. And, I've always been a secret admirer. Ollie, you paint a picture of kind of you know the hippie dream basically, you know, that, and I'm an old hippie, and that we are all going to be together, you know, kind of loving each other. But recently, that's what I was picking up. Maybe you didn't really say that. Recently, have also been thinking that one of this is for real. I'm not going for laughs now. I feel that very deeply that we need to go into our grief, into our deep emotions, into our sadness, and into lamentation, into a sense of allowing things to arise within us from a very deep place. And I think we need new structures, new ceremonies, new ways of accessing those very deep emotions. It's not going to be easy what we're facing now. And unless we connect with our very deepest strength, we're not going to make it. So, Ollie, how are we going to do the accessing the deeper grief part? Have you got any ideas?
Answer!
I really wasn't
answer.
Expecting that sort of question. I actually feel totally stumped on that one, and I don't think it's relevant for me to answer, I'm sorry.
Well, I'd just like to say that I've known Raga for a very long time. No, I'm not going to start that. There is of different kinds grief along the way. To pretend that all this is going to be done with popular consent and that everyone's going to unite in one great cheer of ecstasy about our plans is to remove ourselves to cloud cuckoo land. Whatever dream we might have of our beautiful low energy future, and it is a beautiful dream, it's not the same as the dreams that those guys are currently having. It's not the same as the dreams that those people who are dreaming as they're flying there of their holidays in Florida are having. We've seen fuel protests brought about by a very small rise in the price of petrol. We've seen large numbers of people taking to the streets and blockading refineries, doing things which we would be quite proud of if only it were the other way around. What we are calling on people to do is something that they have never done before, which is to riot for austerity. In the past, people riot because they want more of everything, not because they want less of everything. Sure, of course we need, of course, more democracy, but democracy, of course, but democracy and justice, unfortunately, are not what bring reactionary movements out into the streets. And we are going to see some very big reactionary movements fighting tooth and nail against what we are calling for. And if we are not prepared for that, if we're not prepared for the political battle of our lives, we will lose. So let's not pretend that this is the primrose path of dalliance with the public we are walking down. This is going to be a very bloody and very unpleasant, but of course non-violent from our point of view, struggle against the greed and acquisitive tendencies of a very large number of people. So prepare yourselves.
I'd like to address my question to George and begin by saying I've had an incredible time here, and the atmosphere in this room tonight especially has been absolutely electrifying, and I'm feeling more empowered now than I think I ever have. There's another aside to it though, is that when we all leave this place and we go out, you know, back out into the world with kind of regular people perhaps, so to speak, how do we begin to talk to them about the kinds of things that you've been proposing in here, which everyone has been so enthusiastic about? How do we start to break something like that to them, which is going to require such an upheaval in their whole kind of structures of thought and living and that kind of thing?
Well, the first thing I'd say is this, that of course much of what we're doing is currently pitched at the media, and we have to go through this grossly distorted filter in order to have some chance of reaching a lot of people. But the most important and the most effective medium of all is the one inside our own mouths. It is our tongues, it is our own voices. And no one is persuaded, really, by what I write or by what anybody else writes or what anybody says on television. What they're persuaded by is their friends and neighbours saying, this is a problem which affects not humanity in general, but you. You hypocrite reader, you are the one that we're talking about here, not just people out there. And that's something which only you can do. There's nobody else can do that. I can't do that. No journalist can do that on behalf of people in this room. Now, of course, in doing this, you will simultaneously expose yourself to two completely contradictory charges. People will, in the same breath, call you a pious Puritan and a hypocrite. I know this because I get called both things all the time. And I think, well, I can't really be both, but apparently that is the case. And you will be dismissed as a loony. You will have every possible thing thrown at you by people who want to do anything except face what you are telling them. And the only possible response to that is to persist and persist and persist. And eventually the logic of what you're saying and the logic of the situation does come through. And I know that because I've done it many, many times myself. I'm sure many of you have done exactly the same thing as well, and you will be rebuffed time and again. But if you stop and fall back as a result of that rebuttal, then there's no way we're going to win this struggle. You must go in with the confidence that they'll force you to sit down once or twice or three times, but the third or fourth time, they will just simply have to listen to what you've got to say.
Hi, I've just been asked just to respond to that as well, so I'm making a comment as well. But I mean, I really think that what George said was spot on. But in terms of a social movement and thinking about diversity and the importance of growing and the importance of speaking to people and relating to people, but not at the camp. There's been highs and lows during the media this week, but one of the great highs for me is when the Times published that we are a new social movement that cannot be pigeonholed, and I think that's really vital.
Okay, so we've only got time for one more.
But remember, part two continues in London.
We had a hand already over there from that gentleman, and I know there's a lot of other people want to ask questions. I'm really sorry we just don't
have time, but
it's in London. There's two things I'll say while Mick is passing the microphone over. One is that Richard is doing a workshop on Zero Carbon Britain tomorrow at 12 o'clock in Workshop Space 3. I'm sure he was going to say that anyway, but just in case. And the other is I was asked to tell everyone that the Central Kitchen is doing food, so if you're hungry after this, you can go and get a snack.
This is a question to George. I just want you to reconcile the requirement for heat energy in the equation, and how does that come from the electrical sources you talk about?
Thanks very much. Heat is by far and away the most difficult issue to crack, simply because it can't be nearly so easily transported as electricity. It's something which it is a requirement for many people in this country. Someone shouted, put a jumper on, but if you're an old lady living in a house and you can't afford to heat it and you've already got five jumpers on, that advice isn't going to go down very well. Some of the stuff in the Zero Carbon Britain report is very interesting on this. I mean, we're talking about using electricity to power not only ground-sourced heat pumps, but heat pumps making use of other low-grade heat sources. But I think also we're going to have to look at hydrogen fuel cells as a heating source in our homes as well. And that means a hydrogen piping network, and that's very difficult. A lot of these things, while they're technologically feasible, will require a massive rollout program. The sort of thing which is going to require much more state intervention than this neoliberal economy will currently accept. In other words, you start with an issue which is technical, which is an engineering issue, like the one you raise. You immediately see it runs into an economic issue, which then runs into a political issue, which then runs into a social issue. And so this is where I think all four of us on the panel completely agree that you cannot just pigeonhole them into technical, economic, political, or social issues. And I'm sure most people in the room would agree with that. We have to do all four of those things at once. To neglect any side of that is to doom our efforts to failure. But to pull them all together, to be fighting against all those forces whilst pursuing those specific technological engineering solutions, then we have a chance of making it happen. But it's none of it is going to happen by itself. And I'd just like to, because the subject of heat has been raised, end on this note. That I went to see a source of heat last week in South Wales. The first scrapings of the ground on what will be the biggest open cast coal mine in Western Europe. And it's been forced through against the will of local people, and it's been forced through because the government, when it considers the very issues that we're talking about today, our future sources of energy, doesn't picture wind turbines churning away in the Irish Sea or even desert solar thermal in the Sahara. It pictures coal, because coal is the energy future which it's now set its heart on. It knows that the gas is running out. It knows that the CBI and other big business interests have no interest whatsoever in switching to renewables, and secretly, in the most underhand, the most dastardly way, it is going round all over the country approving open cast coal mines. There's a whole new load, there's 10 new ones just been approved all over the country, a whole load more in the pipeline, and approving a massive increase in the imports of coal because three new coal-burning power stations are in the pipeline. Coal will return to Britain as both a source of electricity and a heating fuel unless we prevent its re-emergence. So in other words, what I'm saying to you is trust no one. Trust no one to deliver the solutions which we're calling for unless they are forced to do so. And they will only be forced to do so if we can muster more democratic power than the undemocratic power mustered by the Confederation of British Industry, by BAA, by the coal industry, by the power generation industry, by all the other factors, all the other industries which are driving the consumption of fossil fuel. The political challenge is like no challenge that any of us have ever faced before. And what I want you to do in this camp and after this camp is to rise to that challenge in a way that you have never risen before. This will be the mobilization of our lives. Thank you.
All right, pick it up for George and his final thoughts. But it's only fair that the other panelists should also get their own Jerry Springer style final thought. So if you're ready for it, start thinking of your message, your final thought, and they'll pass it over to you, Richard.
Thank you. We're going to continue. That one better? We'll be continuing our research, and what I can really see is the analogy that best suits in my head is for us all to be battering down the door. Once the door is battered down, we can throw the answer in there. And I think that our report, I'd encourage you to go away and read it, come to the workshop tomorrow. I think we need to give them the answers so that they have no excuses, and I think that's where our job comes in. But like George said, this is a huge movement that needs to mobilise itself, and we all need to batter those political doors down as much as we can, because they won't listen to us unless we do it.
Okay, I would want to say that it's obviously great to see you all here, but I'm a little bit disappointed that there weren't this number of people in the action discussion that went previously, and I just wanted to remind everyone about the opportunities that we have. Of course, we need to debate and we need to learn, but there's not going to be very often that you are in a field with hundreds, if not thousands, of other people who are here and prepared to step out of line and to take direct action against major corporate climate criminals. And I really encourage everyone to get involved in that process, because we've got a huge opportunity here. So please, have a good think about it, and please, everyone, get involved in that process, because it's really important.
I think I just want to end by maybe clearing up a couple of things. I hope that what I said didn't come across as thinking that if we could just sit around and, you know, sort of have a great time together and live simple lives, that everything would be okay. It's going to be absolutely essential that we take on the forces that are forcing us into this disaster, and we're going to have to do that with courage and determination, as George mentioned. I want to just say a word about dreaming. Dreaming came up earlier. A couple of years ago, when a few of us were talking about the climate camp, I think you could have said that it was a bit of a dream. And, you know, here we are with maybe 1,000 people here, and who knows where we'll be in 2 years. It's really important that as we deal with the necessities of the huge scale of the changes that are needed, that we remember that we have to keep dreaming about the world that we want to create, because only by keeping our focus on that horizon will we be creating the world that is actually better than this one. And that combination of dreaming and determination to fight, etc., all the bad stuff, is what's going to carry us through. Woo. Thank you.
Thank you to all of our panellists, they've been great, and also you as an audience have been great, very patient with the late start and everything. Those of you who'd like to carry on with this discussion, it is going to be continuing in the London neighbourhood, which I'm not exactly sure where that is actually, this camp is so huge, just there. Those of you wanting to continue the action plenary from earlier, please can you cluster around the table.